Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Mona, EB5 is such a difficult area, such a nuanced area. I mean, that's why we've been doing this show for almost 7 years now, about 170 episodes. There's a lot of difficult topics and still a lot of questions come in, right?
Well, yes. I mean, you really, EB5 is just in its own department. It's not immigration. It's not business. It's not corporate. It's not securities. It's just a medley of all of them and with its own specific rules and regulations. It's really not easy to master. And to be fair, it's not easy to master and it's not, let alone adjudicate. Today, Mark, we have the first in a series of podcasts, which we have put together to relate what you may call a series of unfortunate events, or you talking about USCIS, we might decide to call it a comedy of errors. I really don't know.
We'll leave that up to the listener.
But today, to talk about a lot of specifics about the way USCIS is handling everything, or rather how they're not handling everything, mm-hmm. We are very lucky to have Angelo Paparelli.
Hello, my pleasure.
Angelo, thank you for joining us on today's episode of EB5 Investment Voice. For those of you that aren't familiar with Angelo, he is a certified immigration law specialist in California, as well as a partner at Saifife Shaw LLP, a fellow in the College of Labor and Employment Lawyers, and focuses on employment as well as investment-based immigration, which is why he's a natural guest for EB5 Investment Voice. He also serves as an expert witness and consultant on immigration issues arising in litigation. Oh, there's that tie-in with what Mona was talking about earlier. He is also an advocate for due process reforms to America's immigration laws. Angelo, it's great to have you on.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to a lively chat.
Well, and on top of all of that, Mark, he's also a veteran in the field of EB5. Angelo, oh my goodness, what do we say? Do we say a series of unfortunate events with all that has happened over the last 3 years? I swear, if somebody had written a script and presented it to someone, maybe Hollywood or whatever, I am sure they would have said, no, this is not being published. This is far too outlandish. This could not happen. What have we been through in the last 3 years?
Well, Mona, I would call it a series of foreseeable unfortunate events because there have been, as you know, several efforts to try to institute security and integrity measures into the EB5 program. There were the failed USCIS regulations that sought to do that, but which were thrown out because Mr. Wolf was not authorized to sign the regulations. And then we had several efforts in Congress culminating in the Integrity Act, RIA.
Well, to be fair, we have been fighting, or rather Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy have been fighting for this since 2015, because that was the first time, if you remember, when we all thought that was it. This is happening. This is coming in. It's hard to imagine that was so many years ago.
Well, much has happened since then, and this is now embedded in a very complicated statute that goes on for page after page with dense text, and it'll be a long time coming for the final interpretations to come out. I think you've seen that regulations are to be issued, and none have even been proposed, so stay tuned.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. How can we move forward? How can USCIS move forward without regulations, business as usual, with all that is happening, and not mess up? It's just not possible.
Well, I would say, ironically, there will be a dialogue, at least by reason of the terms of the Bering settlement, under which USCIS is required to consult and discuss and possibly negotiate how they are going to implement this statute as part of the settlement agreement. So
I agree.
It's not as if we will wait and let them drop a load of malarkey on top of us. There'll be some dialogue.
Well, you know, that was one of the best things which came out of the Bering settlement. And I will say kudos to the Bering brothers who actually did push that. But here's the issue, which I'm going to ask you. A lot of people are wondering, they've asked us, does this mean that only the people who were part of the litigation can speak with USCIS? Or is USCIS now open to speaking with everyone? And if they're speaking with everyone, how is that going to be structured? You know, do you have any insight?
Well, we know that they have public engagements, which are oftentimes just listening sessions. And it's very difficult to discern whether anything we say actually registers with the agency in some of those engagements. But I am inferring, and if I'm incorrect, let me know, but I thought IIUSA was also a party in the Bering settlement. And that would be an organizational voice for everyone to get behind in the Regional Center Project Developer community.
Well, that only people who are members of IIUSA. So in a way, it would be forcing people to be part of IIUSA, which I personally don't think is a bad thing. I think there should be one unified voice, because right now, look, not just right now, but look how we have gone through the last few years. We've been a whole splintering of so many different voices. There's so many different
camps. And that's
camps.
True.
Yeah.
That's true. There are, unfortunately, different opposing views about almost everything in this field of EB-5. And I'm not sure, to answer your question, how much the agency will listen. But there will be public opportunity for public comment during the rulemaking process. And those comments can be in writing, and they're a matter of public record. And so there will be a way. Usually when the agency promulgates a final rule, they will have to discuss what the commenter said. And oftentimes they try to wiggle around the remarks. But nevertheless, it is a forum from which we can express our thoughts.
You know, you say it's a series of foreseeable, unfortunate events. We had Jen Hermansky on the show a little while ago, who made a big noise about the fact that we have not had any notice and comment period for any of the forms and that we are supposed to have. And hence, there are issues and there are problems which are coming up with those forms. Do you foresee the same?
Well, yes. Paperwork Reduction Act says that you cannot burden the public and you cannot put a number, an OMB control number on a form unless you have followed the requirement of notice and opportunity for comment. And as I read these forms, they are not very instructive of what the agency has in mind. Some of them are less demanding than the earlier generation of forms prior to the Integrity Act. And so we are stumbling as the agency begins to offer its interpretation of what the forms mean and what they require in requests for evidence. And so there's a certain reactivity here, but there's also an anticipation, because once the word gets out, and it does get out, about what the agency is asking for in requests for evidence, then people who file a little bit later know how to modify their submission. So they are at least standing a better chance of addressing the concerns that USCIS raises in the request for evidence.
Yeah, but if you have been in this industry for a while, and if you have any kind of experience in putting regional centers together, it's nothing new, Angelo. It's some things that we have been doing for years. I mean, that whole RFE, which came up, which we discussed in the public policy meeting, was related to something that everybody should be putting in their petitions anyway.
Well, I would say there's far more granularity now. What people may have had in terms of an internal standard operating procedure may encompass 2 to 3 pages. And now the level of detail the agency wants, and I've drafted some of these policy compliance policies, can go on for page after page after page. And every time you hear about a new RFE, you have to modify your compliance policy to address the new points raised. So I would say these are much more emboldened set of demands than existed before. And to be sure, there have always been law-abiding compliant regional centers and project developers, but then there have also been organizations that have been less vigilant.
The vigilantes.
Yeah.
Right. Would you know, I'm all for giving the small guy, the new people, a chance. As much as I do get on and I like some of the big boys, I do think that they need to move over at times and give new organizations an opportunity. But I think, Angelo, you're going to agree with me here. Where the buck stops, or where we're going to see an issue perhaps with a lot of these forms, are those organizations who want to have their finger in every pie, who want to be the general contractor, who want to be the regional center, who want to be the developer, etc.
Well, sure. And the possibility that they will be overextending is there. But on the other hand, I think a fair-minded observer could find fault with the so-called rent-a-center concept, because not every center that puts its availability out there for rental is as scrupulous as one might hope. And I'm not besmirching any one person or entity by any means, but the old saying that my mother gave me, tell me who you go with and I'll tell you who you are. If you get affiliated with a regional center that falls into disrepute with the agency, that can take down a lot of projects, unrelated projects. And so I don't know that there's an easy answer, easy solution, other than full compliance and procedures to mitigate or reduce or address conflicts of interest, a number of things that need to be done. And whether it's all under one roof or whether it's with different players, it still is going to require a fair amount of rolling up one's sleeve and articulating the policies and revealing them in ways that were never expected before.
You know, you are right, Angelo. And the other thing I do really want to point out here is that when you have a lot of experience in the industry, a lot of the projects come in to EB5 in search of cheap capital. I mean, that's basically the bottom line here. And the better projects often have an option to be able to get a bank loan. But if we are going to have so much compliance, someone somewhere isn't going to get paid very much. Will that eventually harm the project or the investors in a different way? You know, I don't know. What is your opinion? Because there is a ton of compliance out there. And from what I see, people don't really want to pay regional centers more money to handle all the compliance.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's clear to me that there certainly is going to be greater regulation of parties that have been previously unregulated, namely the migration agents. And the work of maintaining compliance is going to increase the capitalization requirements for regional centers to be freestanding, profitable entities. So I think that we may see a greater set of specified, spelled out administrative fees that will be borne by the investors. I think that's where the source of recompense for these additional costs will originate.
Maybe, but I've already started witnessing some of the shenanigans which went on previously, where a lot of the big projects, the sort of the big regional centers, pay an agent 2% and an investor 0.5% just to make sure that they get that investor. I mean, I hoped that RIA, the Integrity Act, the new Integrity Act, would have stamped out that practice, but it doesn't seem to have done.
Well, there's a host of new USCIS forms, admittedly not in compliance with the Paperwork Reduction Act or the Administrative Procedure Act, but there's a host of them, and one of the forms is for the migration agent and promoter to sign. And admittedly, the long arm of federal jurisdiction may not extend to every country abroad, but oftentimes statements made under penalty of perjury get people in trouble if they decide to visit America and go to Disneyland. So I think it's too soon to say. My sense is that there's going to be a settling in and becoming better acquainted with what this law requires. And, you know, there may be those who flout the law, but that's always been the case. And that's what law enforcement is all about.
Angelo, as I said from the outset, we are going to this is the first in a series of podcasts relating to a lot of things that USCIS is suddenly doing. But I'd like your opinion here, with all of your experience, do you think USCIS is up to the mark on their ability to be able to monitor regional centers and to be able to work under RIA at this stage?
Well, they certainly have more firepower. There was a provision in the Integrity Act that says that they can hire people who are exempt from the normal civil service pay levels. And I think you're going to see many more sophisticated reviewers. I've often wondered about the role of the internal economist at USCIS or the internal corporate specialist or securities law specialist at USCIS and how that results in ultimately an adjudication with no name or signature associated with it. But I think we're going to see an effort. You can imagine that there will be oversight and USCIS will have to go before Congress and explain what they've done. And neither Senator Grassley or Senator Leahy are going to be very patient with failures of oversight. And I think that in part explains why they are taking a very expansive interpretation of the phrase in the statute, persons involved with the regional center. They're going on the regional center's website or the NCE's website, if they have one, or the JCE's, and they're picking people who appear on there as if they are falling within the definition of persons involved with a regional center. But that's a stretch, and that shouldn't happen because ultimately it requires that the individual have direct or indirect position of substantive authority to make operational or managerial decisions over pooling, securitization, investment release, acceptance, control, or use of EB-5 funds. And not everybody who's on the website at a regional center has that level of authority. Right. And so I think they're trying to avoid being subject to criticism, withering criticism by Congress. But is USCIS up to it? They've got a lot on their plate, and they haven't even been able yet to publish a new fee rule.
So you've been busy, Angelo, with that new fee rule, right?
Well, with the last fee rule, I was somewhat busy because I filed an amicus brief on behalf of the Alliance of Business Immigration Lawyers. My brief was sort of a rifle shot, but I think a powerful one, in that we challenged the authority of USCIS to use fraud detection and national security, the directorate that they formed to perform site visits and engage in other sorts of activities where they swoop down unannounced at a place of business or at a home and begin asking questions. And we said USCIS under the Homeland Security Act is limited in what they can do to the act of adjudication of requests for immigration benefits. And investigative acts are the province of CBP and ICE. And the court never reach that question. So that's going to be another issue that will come up when the new fee rule comes. And the amount of money spent on FDNS is not small. That could be better dedicated to reducing processing backlogs and leaving the active investigation to the law enforcement entities, ICE and CBP, and let the chips fall where they may. But it seems to me that they're going to have a hard time getting a fee rule, but they absolutely need one. And Congress has given them increases that all they have to do is turn on a switch and they can start doing premium processing. But if you look at how they've done premium processing elsewhere, it's been almost absurd. I'm sure you've seen that if you want to petition for a first preference manager or executive and you want to file for premium processing, you can only do it if your case has already been backlogged for almost a year. So that's not, I think, premium processing by any means.
Well, there's this whole option with regards to rural and infrastructure of being priority processing. And nobody knows. So people keep asking me, is this expedited? I said, no, I don't know what definition USCIS is going to give to priority processing, but it's not premium processing and it's not expedited.
Right.
And they have a year to clear the backlog, Angelo. That's before the rules in REA really start kicking in. But so far, I have seen, and I know you don't really want to comment too much on this, and we're going to comment it on later, but so far I've seen that they're clearing the backlog by just giving blank denials.
That's only going to create a new backlog for the AAO, and unfortunately this new statute gives the Administrative Appeals Office exclusive preliminary jurisdiction over decisions, and the AAO doesn't even list EB-5 on its processing chart. And so that's another house that's in disarray and disorder that USCIS needs to clean up, not only for EB-5, but for everything that goes up to the AAO.
I sense litigation coming on.
Well, there may be some room for that if the AAO cannot keep up with reasonable timeframes, because I would imagine that the courts would not be interested in hearing an individual EB-5 case, but perhaps a pattern or practice of AAO malfeasance might be appropriate. You know, the one unusual thing about the AAO is that they say they can find the facts anew. And so sometimes they pull something out of left field and throw it at the employer without a reasonable opportunity to even address it. And something that the IPO or whatever lower body within USCIS may have found as a ground of refusal is not even relied upon. Instead, something new comes up. So there's a lot of, in my view, misbehavior behind the AAO that could be subject to litigation.
I mean, Mark hasn't jumped at us right now, but for our listeners who don't know, AAO is the Administrative Appeals Office, another administrative body. It isn't independent. It's still part of Homeland Security. And it's now, unfortunately, the step which all denied cases have to take before they can go directly to a federal judge. And I can say the industry really fought this. Here, Senator Grassley, pressurized by USCIS, put his foot down. We are going to talk about this a lot more, Angelo, but your thoughts on just the very fact that this particular provision has, it has denied unjust 526 EB-5 decisions from real judicial review.
Well, it has indeed, and it's not going to get any better. We've seen that USCIS is finding its sea legs in dealing with the new statute, and it is likely that unless this new cadre of more highly compensated experts are hired and they make intelligent, reasoned, fact-based decisions and law-based decisions, we're going to see a lot of denials. And that's not to mention the removal of conditions, the I-829. The remedy there is to go in front of an immigration judge. And heaven forbid that an EB-5 investor has to go into the backlog of immigration court cases. Then when they finally get their hearing on the merits, have to explain the EB-5 program to a judge that does nothing but cancellation of removal and asylum every day. It's going to be a mess. I mean, that much we can predict. And that's why I said foreseeable unfortunate events.
Angelo, you've seen a lot of RFEs, requests for evidence. Are there any trends? Are there any commonalities? And if so, what are some things that petitioners and immigration attorneys can do to get ahead of these?
Well, the best thing you can do is monitor trends and stay in contact with colleagues who can share, without naming their clients, what the RFE trends are. One, for example, is almost a silly request for evidence that basically said, we see that you have a process for auditing compliance to satisfy the Integrity Act. But what do you do if you find non-compliance? And so the RFE in question was extremely well documented and extremely sophisticated. And that was kind of a duh moment, because what you do when you find non-compliance is you go to a root cause analysis of finding what was the reason for the non-compliance with a particular provision and how do you remedy it so it does not recur. I mean, that's one that now every submission of an I-956 should include. Another that I've seen is with respect to the filing fees that are to be paid. The Integrity Act increases filing fees and earmarks them for an EB-5 integrity fund, but it doesn't say where those filing fees should come from. And it's another one of those obvious points, but that the filing fees should not come from the minimum capital investment amount of the EB-5 investor, and that the regional center is going to have to come up with those amounts separate and apart and be able to do a kind of inquiry into the path and source of those funds, much like what investors have to do with their own money. And so that those are two that are really quite easy to address. The ones about persons involved with a regional center is difficult because you have to prove a negative that people are not involved with the regional center. So although you may submit the bona fides form, the I-956H, for people who actually have authority over EB-5 funds, those who do not, you're going to have a pretty detailed job description to show that nothing they touch is an indirect involvement with EB-5 funds. And you're going to have very clear statements in bold letters. This person is not involved because they have no such authority in every single case for those who are on your website, but who are not really influential in determining how the funds are dealt with.
Didn't I say, Mark, that this is a difficult area and now it's got more difficult by the minute? It touches everything. Yeah, it really does.
It did. And Angelo said that one of the things to do is stay up on top of trends and ask your colleagues what's happening. And of course, if you can't do that or haven't done that yet, I think this episode right here is a good primer to get started. We've already picked out the three good RFE trends and how to avoid them.
Angelo, you have to come back after a few months and tell us more trends that you're seeing, because it's obvious to me that you're seeing a lot.
Well, I'm glad to, and I enjoy speaking with both of you. You're very agile in your questions and comments, and so I'm grateful.
Well, thank you. And hopefully when he comes back, he'll say, well, there are no RFEs because everyone else is a listener to this podcast and knew how to get ahead of it. And then, you know, immigration wasn't creative enough to come up with other reasons to almost deny or NOID or at least an RFE.
If you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you.
You know, I'm going to have to see proper documentation for that, Angela. All right. Well, that having been said, Angela Paparelli, thank you so much for coming on this episode of EB5 Investment Voice.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshawlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.